Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This show is about what matters most in our life. And at this point, I think it's probably coronavirus. But our mind, thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life with all that it brings to us. Now, I want to give you, in respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering sliding scale online psychotherapy and life coaching to anyone who's suffering financially until March 31st, then going on as we're complete, continuing with all that's going on. And I want you guys to know that we have a free, yes, it's free, sharing meeting with me, with me and a lot of other experts, Thursdays at 6 p.m. via Zoom. And you can go to my Twitter, Dr. Zain, or my Instagram, Dr. Fujian Zain, and to get the meeting ID. I'll tell you real quick, 689-941-5883 is the meeting ID. So in this show, I'll have, I think probably you're seeing her, Eileen Manoukian. She's a founder and director of Gem Educare, who will be speaking with us real quickly about what to do with our children at this time of lockdown before all of you pull your hair out. And then we'll speak to Melody Moezi. And actually, I have taped Melody Moezi. She's a writer and an attorney, the author of The Rumi Prescription. She's an author of several bestsellers and writes frequently for The New York Times, Washington Post, and Huffington Post, and appears on CNN, NPR, and BBC. Please listen for the interview. She's amazing. She has gone and suffered all of her life in bipolar. She shares with us what she has gone through and what any of us can learn when we're going through some of the aspects. So remember, sharing with Dr. Fujian Zain every Thursday, 6 p.m. It's free for all in zoom.com and check it out. Now, I want to talk to Eileen Manoukian, and she's going to give us the tip of the week today with what to do with our kids. Welcome to my show, Eileen.
Thank you. Good afternoon. So as you know, I am expert in toddlers and very, very young children. So from 0 to 5 years old. So whatever I say, you can use for a 6 or 7 year old, but it might not be good for your teenagers. So don't think that everything I say you can use for any age kids. The best thing you can do with your kids when they are home is, first of all, when you're doing something, explain it to them step by step. They love learning processes. They love organization. If you're cooking something, tell them what you're doing. Get them involved. If they are very young, you can ask them to, for example, if you're cooking something and you have vegetables, ask them to count the peas and put them in the pot. Or give them a separate plate and tell them to organize all the carrots on one side and the peas on the other side. That will keep them engaged very long. If you're doing laundry, ask them to put the socks together. They love doing things that adults do. And don't forget to praise them for what they are doing. Tell them they are doing a great job. Thank you. You're so helpful. This is really making my life easy. You're such a great helper. They love that. Another thing you can do, if you have to work on your computer and your toddler has to be there, but you can't spend that much time with them, is tell them to go and organize their toys. One day tell them to do it by color. One day tell them to do it by size. One day tell them to do it by shape. Put your cars in one corner, all your teddy bears in one corner. They love doing stuff like that. And then again, don't forget to praise them. Don't forget to make sure that they are doing some physical activity. You want to get them tired to take a nap so you can have your job done. If the weather permits and you have a backyard, take them outside, let them run around, ride a bike. If the weather is not permitting it, make sure they are dancing inside the house, jumping up and down, becoming popcorns that are popping in the pot, something like that, so they can use their energy and empty it. If they are 3 years old or over, you can give them scissors and old magazines or newspapers and have them cut some shapes. You can tell them one day to cut all the people's faces. And then the next day you can ask them to cut all the fruits. We receive a lot of junk mail in the mail. Use them. Don't throw them away. Try to use everything you have at home for doing crafts. when you take them outside, tell them to collect some rocks or collect some leaves, bring them inside, glue them on a paper. They love doing crafts. Use the toilet paper that is very valuable right now. You can use the middle part of it, make binoculars for them, make butterflies for them. You can make anything out of that. You can also have them sit next to you while you're working. Give them a piece of paper. Tell them this is office hours. You do your office hour and I do my office hours. Either give them a coloring paper to color a specific shape or a specific picture, or give them just a plain paper and tell them to write a story. They don't know how to write. It's okay. They will just do something with it. Draw a picture of the backyard. And they will do that. And they will leave you alone for the time they are doing it. You have to once in a while say, oh, wow, what a nice picture. Continue doing it. And they will get busy with it. These are some of the easiest things to do.
Beautiful. There is also... Thank you so much. They are so many. I love them. As I was hearing them, I could visualize them. And thank you for bringing some sort of sanity to all of the couples who are home with their toddlers, who used to be at daycares or used to be at school. And then now, you know, both mom and dad are supposed to be home and trying to entertain these toddlers all day. I had a friend who she was funny. She says, I have done everything possibly in my imagination. I've run out of ideas. What do I do? And I said, listen to Eileen Manoukian. And for all of you, she's going to be creating a lot of these ideas for us. And kind of like every week, we'll have some a little bit of an episode about what she's going to, Eileen Manoukian from GEM Educare is going to let us know. And thank you, Eileen. We'll be right back with Melody Moezi, the author of Rumi Prescription. It's an amazing book, and it's she's done a great job in how she explains it and about her life story. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Melody Moezi.
Take KMET 1490 AM with you everywhere you go by downloading our free smartphone apps found on the KMET website, KMET1490AM.com. You can also go to the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store on your phone to download the free app. Now you can listen live or play any of your favorite programmers' podcasts using your smartphone. Don't miss out on the free KMET smartphone apps. Go to KMET1490AM.com and download your free phone app today.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want, by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm so excited to have Melody Moezi with me again. She's been on my show before, and I'm so excited that she has the new book, The Rumi Prescription, and we're going to talk about her experience and spirituality. Well, welcome to my show, Melody.
Thank you so much for having me, Fujian.
I had a different experiencing reading this book that I had your last book. Mm-hmm. And although you talk and share about your personal experience, your ups and downs in life and with, you know, bipolar, but this book just had a different feel in the way you were sharing yourself.
you were not sharing yourself only from a condition, a mental condition, which had a little bit more of that in your last book. Right. This was like I was experiencing you truly just as a human being. Like you shared as a turmoil that a human being might have with no name, like not necessarily putting it under a condition or you know, mental illness or disorder. It wasn't that. It just came through, Melody, like you were sharing with your friends. And you know, it's almost like your audience were just your friends. And you were really sharing a personal story about your relationship with your dad and how, you know, you came to him with what he used to come to you as a natural way of, you know, sharing himself and the wisdom of the world. And you said, well, as a child, I'm like, yeah, yeah, whatever. You know? And as you have grown up and you have gone through this, you come in like, wow, there was something. And just to share personal with you, when I was reading yours, I remember my mom used to come to me at when I was little, and she used to say, you have to rehearse and remember poetry from four different poets from, you know, and I had no idea. I would just kind of like recite them without, you know, like you said, you know, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, I know how to read and write, but the poetry is so rich. How could I understand it? And for me, it was one of those concepts of like, okay, I'll just say whatever it is, but not understand it. Sure. And when you were talking about your experience, it really brought a land home for me in how I had experienced and how much our family and our cultures try to bring the wisdom into our life from such a rich culture. So tell me what your experience has been writing this book.
Well, again, thank you so much for having me on. My experience in writing it was, as somebody with bipolar disorder who knows what clinical mental illness is like, I thought, you know, I understand that side of the world. I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to cope with this illness, talked to a lot of other people who are living with different sorts of mental health conditions. So I feel like I have that covered, but so once I got to the point where I had that covered and I feel like I'm treating my condition and doing it pretty well, I realized there's a different kind of madness. There's a different kind of insanity that is absolutely not exclusive to those of us with mental health conditions. And in some cases, those of us without mental health conditions, because we're not forced to take care of ourselves in certain ways, maybe even more. So just typical anxiety, not to the clinical level, but how bad that's gotten these days, that just very standard anxiety or distraction or depression that doesn't rise to the level of a clinical mental health condition, but is just as dangerous in so many ways, because at least with the bipolar disorder, I have medication. I have like there's something I can do. But then you think about what do you do about ego, right? Like what is the medication for just not having that sense of how connected we are as human beings, and that if I hurt you, I'm also hurting myself, right? What do you do about that? Which is, you know, rampant in our current society. So one of the things that inspired me to write the book was just realizing how common these sorts of diagnoses were, and how Rumi really did have all these different prescriptions for us. And his poetry is so dense and so difficult, but I happen to have an avid Rumi addict in my life, and my father had always encouraged me to learn more about Maulana, and I you know, I was interested to the extent that a bratty kid might be interested, and I really took it for granted for a long time, and it wasn't until I had this acute manic episode and psychotic break, which happened because I didn't know I had bipolar disorder. So, and that's the only episode like that I've ever had, because had I known what it was, I would have been able to treat it at the time. But I didn't. So it got completely acute. But before it got to the point of psychosis and acute mania, I had this beautiful mystical experience that is not unlike how you hear other mystics describe their experiences, but also people who have psychedelic experiences, you hear them describe feeling connected to other human beings in ways that they hadn't before, sort of like their horizons open. And I felt that completely, but not being a mystic, you know, mystics, they prepare for this. And you know, this notion of fana, the annihilation of the ego. I experienced that for maybe a minute or two, but because I hadn't prepared for it, you know, they prepare with fasting, prayer, charity, all these other things, devotional practices that I had not prepared for, I quickly descended into acute mania. But that memory of that was very vivid, to the point that it's something that I can't forget. That's something, it's a gift that I was given, and I'm very grateful for it. The fact that it coincided with this clinical mental health condition made it very difficult, because I had the standard modern mental health system telling me, this is garbage, you need to throw this away. Meanwhile, I had my faith community telling me, the medical system is garbage, throw them away, right? So my hope with this book, partly, and I have a lot of hopes with it, but one of them is to encourage those of us who have these experiences to be able to accept both sides of them as valid.
I actually have heard from a lot of clients that I work with that they were going toward the mania, because obviously, as you have experienced, you feel very normal for many, many, many weeks or years. And then there's this escalation that starts happening, and the chemistry of the brain is changing. And then at that moment, there is a period where you are expanding in many, many layers. And I get that the expansion, it has a lot of positivity, it has love, and it has a deep sense of connection, that this is just expands. And beyond that, then, you know, it goes into psychosis. And most people don't even attempt to go to call any professionals before it hits the psychosis, because this is just the best that any human being can ever imagine being. So whatever the chemistry of the brain is, it's ours. So that essence is ours. And that, to me, that's what it shows, that whatever you're experiencing, it's what the capacity of the brain has. And then beyond that, obviously, it doesn't stop there, and it goes to a different layer, because it's not, it's on automatic. Because I think you're talking about people who go through spirituality or meditation or, you know, different path, they do it as if they're in control of their brain. Where when your condition, necessarily, you're not in control of your brain, you're managing whatever is happening with other stuff. But I could see where, and I've sensed it from a lot of my clients, that that part does appear that go beyond the day-to-day realm of understanding and perceptual concept that we have, and our perceptions really, really expands. Which I can see it matches many of the meditators and spiritual people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wish we could accept both sides of those things without forcing somebody to push one side of it away. I had a reading the other night before all of the coronavirus shut down everything, all of the readings. It was one of my last readings. And there was a young Iranian-American woman just like me, who was brought to tears in a moment of just saying, you know, they told me it wasn't true, that all of this, I should let go of it. And I was like, it was so beautiful to be able to see not just somebody else who had that experience, but somebody from my exact same background. And as a culture that is so rich in this mystical poetry, we should be especially, and not just so rich in this mystical poetry, also so rich in medicine, in terms of having physicians and psychotherapists and PhDs. I mean, just, you think of this as a super hyper-educated community. Let's use that education in a way that doesn't dismiss literature, in a way that doesn't dismiss art. And I think it can be done. And there is data to show that literature and art, dance, just music, all of these things are actually really helpful when it comes to not only recovering from mental health conditions, but also just living a full life, regardless of whether you have a diagnosed condition or not. We all want to be as well as we can be, and to be contributing as much as we can to the world we live in.
Absolutely. So share with us, what is it that you have learned from Ruby and have been able to apply it to your everyday living?
Yeah. So with this whole, all these cancellations, so this is just one example. Recently, I had a whole tour in California. Hopefully I would have been there in person. I could have been able to see you in person. But all of that was canceled, right? So it's not a convenient time for a book to come out when you have a whole tour and half of it gets canceled. But this is exactly what Molano specializes in, like these moments where everything's not going according to plan, right? And his advice is to set aside certainty and not focus so much on certainty. And only then, when you embrace uncertainty, will you find stability. So there's that. There's also, toward the end of the book, I went to, with my father and my mother, we all went to Rumi, we went to Konya in Turkey to visit Rumi's shrine. And I remember the night before we left, we were at my Auntie Fati's house and my cousin Bita's house. She and her and my Auntie Fati had cooked this amazing meal, right? So we leave Boston at the time, and then we go for almost 2 weeks in Turkey, and we come back, and my husband picks us up from the airport and says, how was it? How was everything? And all of us sort of agreed that the food was not quite as good as we had hoped. And initially we all said, you know, the dinner we had at Bita's house was better than any of the dinner, like anything we ate the whole time we were in Turkey. And which reminded me of this poem that Rumi has where he says, I'll try and do it in Farsi. Right?
And it's actually in English for me.
Yeah. So the translation of it is, my translation is, the literal is just those of you who are going for Hajj, those of you for why seek. So this is the literal one. The looser one is, why seek pilgrimage at some distant shore when the beloved is right next door? And my father's response to that was like, you know, you may have to go across the world to realize that what you have at home is so great. And right now, that's really comforting to think you don't need to go across the world to find the beloved. The beloved is within you, not even just your next door neighbor, but closer to you than your jugular vein inside your own heart. And there's a moment in the book where I recite all these different faith traditions and how we all, whether it's from the Christian tradition of the kingdom of God is within you, or the Jewish tradition of the light of the divine shines within you like a candle. And I went through every tradition to say that this exists in all of our faiths. Yes. And it is something that unites them. And this is what Rumi was so good at, is saying that his religion was love, and that exceeds any creed or nationality. And it was really important to me both to show that, you know, this is a Persian mystic, also from an Islamic tradition, which I know in America right now is something that people really don't understand. But as much as they love Rumi, to be able to say, look, this comes from an Islamic tradition, maybe that's something that they can begin to respect. And likewise, to say that this is something that is rich and accepted within Zoroastrian traditions, within Baha'i traditions, within Jewish traditions, as part of their cultural traditions as Iranians as well, for instance. So it was important for me to present it as having a very strong cultural history and even a religious history, but one that was very expansive instead of limiting.
So for people who are listening to us and have never heard of Maulana Rumi, which whomever ever liked Madonna has probably heard of Rumi, because thanks to Madonna, which brought, you know, which mainstreamed Rumi to the rest of the world. And then Deepak Chopra did, and many, many other.
Well, now Beyonce has named her daughter Rumi. So
yes, Beyonce.
Beyonce and Jay-Z, yeah.
Might not know him, Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, known simply as Maulana, and to the Western world, Rumi, was a renowned 13th century Islamic scholar, theologian, poet, and mystic. And he was born in the Central Asian province of Balkh in 1207 and grew up in an era of deep political turmoil packed with modern parallels, full of walls and bans and wars. And as a result, Rumi spent much of his life traveling extensively throughout the Middle East before settling in the present day Turkey and then central Anatolia. So it's his poetry. It has gone around the world. And you actually have put it here in the new age of Madonna and hip hop, courtesy of Beyonce and Jay-Z, who named their daughter Rumi. And his poetry somehow, and I think that a lot of the spiritual conversations that go around, as you talked about, with different faith, and not just the religion aspect of the rituals of the day-to-day, but each of these faiths have this, mm-hmm. you know, their divine aspect of it, which is more like philosophical and theoretical perspective. And many people know them more now as like new, they look at it as new age, which was really old age, but was more of the theoretical aspect of it, the philosophy versus the ritualistic aspect of it. And we could see that sometimes because they're just theoretical wisdom, that they adapt, those type of wisdom adapt itself to any type of day-to-day event that goes on. And that's why, although it could be like, you know, 1400 years ago, 2000 years ago, 3000 years ago, they still kind of, we value them because we haven't really changed human beings. Maybe our situations have changed, maybe technology has changed, but who we are, our brains has really not changed. And that's why all of those old wisdom can be attributed and brought back to the everyday life. And you know, as you go forth, I have this part that you have. First of all, did you translate all of these yourself?
I did it with my help, the help of my father. So it's me and my father. I pick the words in English. Yeah. And he helped me through the Persian, because as you know, some of the Persian, even it's not the same as modern day.
Yeah. And I've read other translations, but I really want to tell you, I love the way you have translated it. It really sits with my heart. Like, it brought it home for me. It's not like this distant, I don't know what they're talking about. It's more like, oh yeah, you know, I got it. And it just, it lands well. So you write, don't retreat, come near. Don't lose faith, adhere. Seek the tonic nectar in the bitter sting. Go to the source of your spring. In love with insanity, I'm fed up with wisdom and rationality. All those revert from their source, yearn to return as a matter of course. And then you said this, why seek pilgrimage at some distant shore when the beloved is right next door? And die before you die. So what does die before you die mean to you, as Rumi has said?
Yeah, so Rumi cites the Prophet Muhammad in that die before you die. And I think for a lot of Sufis, a lot of mystics, this notion of stopping in your life to think about your own mortality is a way to appreciate what you already have, and stop seeking something else, and to realize that what you need is already within you. And I think that's also a recognition of your immortality, but knowing at the same time that your time on this planet is valuable, that there's something that you want to accomplish while you're here, and not just that you want to accomplish, but there's something that you are brought to this planet to do. And in order to fulfill whatever that promise is that brought you here, that's unique to you specifically, you need to think about ahead. You need to think ahead in terms of, there will be a day that I am not here. And how do I want to live my life so that that day that I'm not here, not only is this planet a better place because it had me on it, but the people around me were affected in a positive way from me as well. But people, philosophers, theologians, like, have interpreted die before you die in so many different ways. For me, what it means is just to quit taking things for granted, and knowing that this inheritance of this poetry for me, as somebody who is an Iranian American who grew up largely here, whose Farsi is really not great. I speak I speak kitchen Farsi, I'll say, and I have fourth grade reading and writing level, so I read very slowly. But to have access to it, the only way I have access to it is through my family that's still alive, thank God. And we forget that there are certain inheritances that are bound. You cannot accept that inheritance or claim that inheritance after someone's death, right? You have to claim it in their life. So knowing that my dad has this vast array of couplets and quatrains memorized in his brain, and knowing that he won't be around forever, just like I won't, I thought, if I want access to this, this is the only way I'm going to get it. He's the only person who's going to be patient enough with me to sit down and say, and also the only person with whom I won't be so embarrassed to be like, I don't know what that word means. I don't know what that word, like, there's so much I don't know in terms of what it means. But he would sit and take the time with me. And sure, he would laugh at me, but like usually for other things, not for like not knowing a word or something else. But it really brought us close together, not just because the poetry is so powerful, but also it's because my father has adored this poetry for so long. And I think the way that you love someone best, the way you learn to know someone best as a friend, let alone as a parent or a family member, is to look at what it is that they love and figure out why. You know, even to this day, as much as I've written a book now about Rumi, my father still adores Rumi far more than I could ever understand or do, but I know him better for going into his world and stepping into that and saying, you know, I value what you are finding so important and valuable. I see the beauty in it. And by seeing the beauty in that, it was a doorway into a deeper, richer relationship with my own father.
And I see this as such a beautiful connection and completion with our families, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember when my mother had dementia and at the end Alzheimer's. And I kept going back to Iran to see her. And it was more like just trying to connect and complete with who she was and kind of like reciting her world and who she was in the media, and you know, who she was as a female who was in the media in Iran. And looking at her life, I can really sense that a lot of forgiveness came from me, from everything that I ever said. You know, I was upset with her, or expectations that I didn't have. I mean, I had that it didn't come through. And I remember that created a certain bond that completed the parent that I had inherited in my head, which was very different than the person who was also growing up in front of my face from one age to the next, you know. Mm-hmm. But as we grow up, we hold the image of a parent who was toward our child at that time. And then it's like at one point saying, wait a minute, I'm not that child, and this person in front of me is not that parent with that child anymore. I'm a grown up, and this human being in front of me has also grown up in a whole different way. And now let me get to know them in a different way as a grown up to grown up. And that's kind of what I'm hearing, what had also happened for you in that relatedness with your father.
Yeah. The greatest gift, I think, of this book is it allowed me to have this kind of friendship with my father that I didn't think was really possible. There's a moment in the book, because we were doing weekly and it turned into twice weekly. He was very excited to keep doing these, just like this sort of video chat kind of classes that just got longer and longer. And during one of those, it was a day that we were supposed to have a class, and a friend of mine had just died by suicide, and I just learned about it. And it just made me spiral into what started off as just a natural grief and depression, but what eventually ended up being more clinical. And the day that happened, normally before all of this, I probably would not have told my dad about what happened. One, because we shared a diagnosis. I didn't want him to have to think about, this is a friend of mine who also has bipolar, who died by suicide. The last thing I want to do is for him to think that that's a possibility for me at all, even though, of course, for anybody with a serious mental health condition, it's a possibility. But I wanted to protect him in a way, right, from that. But the moment I got on the phone to cancel our lesson, he immediately was like, what's wrong? I can tell there's something wrong in your voice. There's something's not right. And I couldn't lie to him in the same way that as a kid, I was very good at it. I mean, I could always be like, nope, nothing's wrong. I'm all fine. Everything's good. But now we were friends, you know, and I don't lie to my friends like that in the same way that I guess growing up, it's so easy to lie to your parents because either you tell yourself you're trying to protect them or you're trying to protect yourself or they would never understand, you know, like there are all these excuses that make it okay. And it didn't just allow me to get closer just to my father. I have an extraordinary mother. You've met her. She's amazing. And she's been really supportive through this whole thing. And as good as my dad is when it comes to memorizing the poems and whatever, my mom is very good at the rhyme and the meter. And she knows a different part of this poetry. And it allowed me to really just to connect with them as human beings on a level that I wasn't sure I ever would be as an adult. And now the conversations we have are so much richer. And I wish I'd been able to do this 20 years ago, you know, but you're ready when you're ready. I just feel really blessed that I was able to do it while they're both still here.
Absolutely. So how has the experience that you've had in learning Rumi's poetry and Rumi's wisdom supported you in two different levels? And I know that I'm purposely separating these two, although both of them are you. Mm-hmm. One as human being who naturally grows from one age to another in the developmental stage. And then the other one through the lens of the part of you that goes through the ups and downs of the bipolar. And most of what I've seen and experienced, and you're personal to this, so you can say if I'm not saying it accurate, to me the experience of the world is as is just at times it appears that, you know, your chemical system gets hijacked and you are not necessarily in control of it. You attempt to manage it, and then, you know, you just kind of pass through the wave, like surf through the wave, waiting for it to pass until you can, you know, be in control again. Am I accurate about that experience?
For sure. For me, yeah. For me, I think that's a really apt description of it. And I think anybody who feels more deeply than other people, and part of my condition as bipolar is my lows are lower than a lot of people and my highs are higher than a lot of people. As a result, I have access to what I consider different realms that are really inconvenient in our current reality. That if I were to let myself fall into those, might kill me in this reality, because I believe in the immortality of the soul. So,
say more what you mean by that.
Inconvenient in the sense that I feel like, as human beings, our capacity for love and connection is beyond anything we can understand. And I think in my acute mania, I wanted to give away all of my belongings. I didn't need it. And in a way, I don't. I get it, right? I don't want to be living on the streets. But a kind of generosity overcame me that is inconvenient in the world we live in, because, and not just generosity on the part of corporations, because, you know, who cares about Visa and MasterCard if I can use my Visa and MasterCard to give money to people who don't have it and need it, or food or clothing or shelter? Like, why wouldn't I buy a house for somebody who's homeless? That just makes sense, you know? And that does make sense. If you have the money to buy a house for someone who's homeless, why not? There's somebody who doesn't have a house. And all of that has like a higher rationality than in this world where I have a credit score and, you know, a debt, and all of the things that are real in this world are just hard to do. I couldn't keep doing that because I wouldn't have stopped, right? So then I would have been homeless too.
Right. There's a responsibility and an accountability to the material world and to others that we have to take into account, although all of that philosophical aspect makes sense.
Right. It totally does. And it would be nice if we could all live like that, but it wasn't feasible, especially when you have, you know, I have a husband, I have family, I have other people who count on me. And I'm definitely a generous person, but I can't be that generous. I can't give away everything that I have so that I have nothing in the end, even though, you know, there's a part of me and it is more the manic side of me. I don't know what you can call it, but that even if I did give all of that away, there's a part of me that deeply believes that I would still be okay. Like I really, and I think it's that part that had that mystical experience that it would still be okay in the end. My husband doesn't have that belief. He doesn't think it'll be okay. He's very rational and very, thank God for him. Like he's saved my life. So, he's much more practical than I am. And I know that I can't live like that. It's not, you know, and that's why I take medication. That's why, you know, but I don't want to pretend that those insights are useless or invalid. It's just, I can't take them to that high degree and still live on this world. Right. And I think in other realms, in other places, I could live like that. Right now in 2020, in Trump's America, this is where I have to live, you know, and I need medication for that to work without endangering myself or my family, you know.
So part of what I'm hearing from you is that the understanding of the ideas are beautiful, but implementing the ideas in the actual life still needs to take other things into condition. But it does not mean that the ideas are wrong or bad, or you know, they don't—they're not valid.
Exactly.
Ideas are valid, but it might not—it might take a different path, or it might not be available at this point. And then that's what you get access to when you are in the manic stage. You get access to a lot of amazing big picture ideas,
right.
And then but implementing them necessarily in the way that it is for you, it's not feasible. And
right.
At that moment, you might not notice that.
Right.
And you might completely get engrossed to the idea. And then definitely with the medication, you put your feet on the ground and you notice it from the other side. And then other people, such as your husband and other people around you, also try to remind you that there's also this other part that needs to be exist. But in that level of being in that space, there is this beauty and the freedom that shows up, which is above and beyond the maybe the strains of the practicality of life that we have to deal with. The chains are no longer there. You're just kind of like expansion of this beauty of love and connection and generosity and how to be with people and how to create love. Now, Rumi obviously has that as far as philosophical, and I can sense that as you were learning about Rumi and this the mystical aspects of he was experiencing with you, you were also relating them to that air right in that stage that you also experienced that, so it was familiar for you in that way. So some part of this this learning was familiar. If you were going to take some of that familiarity and the wisdom and bring it then into your practical life, what I heard from you is more of how to look at things as, don't get attached to them, that you can see things in the realm of day-to-day mundane life, but if you go with it in a way of flow with it, then you won't get attached and you won't go through suffering, which is, we hear it from Rumi, we hear it from Buddha, we hear it from a lot of the spiritual figures that we hear from them, which the wisdom of it is, you're going to go through the practical life and you got to do what you got to do. Just don't get too attached and don't get too attached to any of it, nor your ego, nor life, nor any of it. Because it's the attachment that creates that kind of the misery.
Right. And I think something about Rumi is he really accepts that suffering is part of life and that we need to embrace it. That you cannot, that honey is only sweet because you've tasted vinegar, right? And that every wound that you have summons a sacred light. So all of the things that we, and that there is no good or bad. It's just our label that we put on it. And I know this personally because everything that was supposedly the most objectively bad thing that could happen to me resulted in the most objectively good things that have since happened to me, right? So this idea that something is inherently good or inherently bad just is false. And I think this idea that we can run away from depression, from anxiety, is also false. And Rumi really recognizes that. And that's why he says to welcome every guest, every emotion that comes to us, welcome it and feel it. And for so long before this, especially somebody who's experienced clinical depression, my reaction was always to run as far and as fast as I could to get away from that depression. And to accept, just like the mania, this had nothing to teach me. There was no lesson here. This was just clinical and chemical and electrical. There was nothing in terms of a lesson. But now, once I started getting into this poetry more deeply, I realized that there were lessons in this. There were lessons in terms of, you need to slow down. And you're entitled to that. And it's important to do that. And you're allowed to cry. I think right now in our society, it used to be just for men, I think, that there was this stigma associated with crying, but now also with women as well, that, and almost more with women, because we're, God forbid we cry, right? We'll be considered even weaker. It almost seems like it may be easier for men now. But the point is, one of the greatest coping mechanisms I have is the ability to cry. My dad, he relates it to the best sedative that's humanly available to us is crying. And there's data, there's actual people who've studied this. And it is, and you know this, I mean, you're a doctor, you know these things.
When I'm tired, I automatically cry. I mean, that's the way my body releases even being tired, just cry.
Cry. So yeah.
I'm a big crier. I'd go do lectures.
It's helpful. Yeah. And I think the fear of it and the running away from it, and some people get to the point where they can't cry, for instance, that to me is really dangerous, because this is a natural, sedative that you don't need. And I have no problem with medication, but there's a lot of medications that we use as sedatives that may not be necessary if we just learn to cry. And for all of us, right? I do think that some of the anti-anxiety medications are certainly overused in some people and underused in others, for sure. But I also know that when I embraced being able to cry, my need for any of those sedatives reduced dramatically. And I was able to see it not as a sign of weakness either. And that was hard for me to do as an empowered, independent, 21st century Iranian American woman, to be able to say, no, crying is actually an empowering act. That took a long time, but my dad and Rumi and this poetry really helped me see that, both in terms of crying in response to really negative events and emotions, and also just enjoy. Now I listen to music sometimes and it's just tears start falling down my face, and I have no shame about it anymore in the way that I really used to. And I don't put a lot of judgment into it either, like, oh no, maybe I'm getting depressed, maybe this is something.
Well, I know you for some years, and following your path and your writings, I keep coming to a place that you are becoming so much more closer to you, to your body, to who you are, to your ups and downs and the cycles, and they're all just part of you. And there's not a part of you that you're trying to shun or move away to or ignore or avoid or have shame or embarrassment about. Nothing. It's like, it's all me, whether it's up, whether it's down. Yeah. It's sometimes this and sometimes that, and guess what? It's just all. It really, I get that you're coming to that terms with it.
One of the things I just want to say quickly that really helps me in that is seeing these other powerhouse Iranian American women, and you, and you're in the book, like sitting with you on a panel and being like, look at this extraordinary woman and what she's capable of. Like, being able to see someone like that, and be like, that's where I come from. Like, she comes from the same place I come from. I'm capable of that. And I can't thank you enough for setting that example. And I've been really in awe of you for so long since we first met, and really grateful to you, because it's funny you say that to me. Some of that is a reflection of you back at you.
Thank you. So. Thank you so much, Melody. In 1 minute, I also want to complete with this conversation, because we started with this. We know we're in an era at this point that everybody is suffering from this conversation about coronavirus. Everybody's not suffering from the actual catching corona, but everybody's suffering from the conversation, the fear, panic, all of this of the corona. With what you have learned in your own experience, with what you have learned from Rumi, your parents, and all of that, that you're bringing it all in this wonderful book of the Rumi prescription. Mm-hmm. If you were going to bring some of that teaching and kind of like allocate it to the conversation about corona,
right?
What would you tell our audience? Oh my God, look at that beautiful cat.
I would say, what a great thing that we can stay home with our cats for a little bit. I would again go back to this, the beloved is right next door, you know, these beautiful everyday things in our lives that we see as annoyances, right? Like I'm in the middle of doing an interview with you and this cat wants to sit on my lap. You know, what do I do? Do I say, no, I'm very important. I'm doing something very important and God forbid my cat come and see me. Or do I say there's this beautiful creature in my life who wants some sort of affection from me and say, yes, I'm going to give it. And I'm going to stay home and give it. I think recognizing the things, the beautiful things in our own lives every day that we have, that we don't need to go far from home for, is, and I think this could be a blessing in disguise by forcing us to slow down in ways that we need to. As much as I was disappointed that my events in California were canceled, that my event in Boston was canceled, all these events have been canceled. And as much as I've learned from Rumi, I still tend to fill my life, to fill my calendar every day. And when this happened, suddenly my calendar was empty. And suddenly my husband and I were in the same place and we hadn't been. He's doing his PhD at Harvard. I'm here teaching at UNC Wilmington. But this has now brought us together. Like what a better thing than to be able to be together with the person you love the most, yeah, the animals you love the most. So try and see this as a blessing in disguise. And that doesn't mean that we're not grieving for the people we're losing and that we don't need to wash our hands and do all the other things. But also to see that all everything that's negative has a positive side to it as well.
I remember Sister Jenna, who is the host of the American Meditating Radio, and she is a powerhouse of a woman. I wish one day you would meet her. She talked about this is a global pause for all of us.
Right.
And it's like, we just got to pause. And it's the world is forcing us to just say, okay, what's going on with us? And, you know, we had actually a Zoom conversation, which I mentioned your book in that. And
thank you very much.
You in there. But it was also a conversation about how much we are together, although we have to be in our own kind of community.
Right.
But this is something that we're all going together in it, and we're all going to get out of it together. We're all going to survive it together the same way, you know, humanity has survived many of these things. And just to pause and see what it is that we could look at, all the things we haven't done for a while, and we could just go back and create a lot of good quality time with each other, even if it's done through Zoom or
even if it's done.
so imagine, you know, using that platform in order to keep connecting. So thank you so much for giving
me
your time. I always learn from you and always
Likewise.
Look forward to your next level of growth, which comes in, you know, every time comes in form of books. So everyone who's out there, go get the Rumi Prescription by Melody Moezi. Amazon, or where can they find you?
Wherever books are sold, Amazon, Target, Walmart, everywhere. I encourage you to go to your local independent bookstores. Right now, our local businesses are really struggling. They're going to be closed. I had an event, for instance, at Harvard Bookstore in April that's since been canceled. I know Harvard Bookstore, many other bookstores, your local bookstores, you should check. I had one at Warwick's. I had one at Vroman's in LA. I would check with those bookstores because a lot of them are now no longer charging for shipping, or if they are charging for shipping, they're charging less. And I know they may be, their price may be a little bit more than Amazon, for instance, but you know that you're supporting a local independent bookstore. And that's a really precious thing right now. And they need our support.
Beautiful. It was great to talk to you. Thank you.
It was so great talking to you too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.